let me ask a controversial thing here. Is there a role of psychologically testing people before you put them on the front line, if you will, in a high-pressure cybersecurity environment?
It depends on what you mean by psychologically testing, because there are a load of tests that you can get people to do.
I guess if you're assessing
personality type thing.
I guess, you know what, I, again, a layperson from just my personal experience, I would want to know, does a person have the ability to simply put a pause or an interrupt statement in their thought cycle before taking action?
There are people who think like that, and you can certainly have a look at thinking skills, but something like that, you can train that. Absolutely.
And oh, wow. Meetings, if you could do that, you'd make $1 million because meetings would actually become useful, Beck.
Yes.
I mean, think about it. When we're in a meeting, most of the time, people are really just taking turns talking when they should be listening.
Yeah.
Right. And the fundamental issue is that there isn't an interrupt. Everybody wants to say something.
Yeah.
But that pause function isn't there that says, all right, you know what? Just stop. Let's hear this out.
Yeah. There's two things that are springing to mind, three things. One is emotional intelligence, which I'm fairly sure you'll have heard of, EQ. And that is the ability to understand perspectives of others. There's also a thing called CQ, which is cultural intelligence, which I absolutely love, because those two things combined are teaching you exactly that thing. So what is the other person thinking? What is looking at it from their perspective instead of your own? Why do they think that this particular topic is important and yet you think it's so unimportant? I used to teach cultural specialists in the UK military, and their job was to go to not very pleasant places and to build relationships with people that were very much not like them. And I used to find it really difficult to try and explain these concepts to them because it's all unconscious. And the story that I kind of want to tell here is we were talking about cultural values. So we had two people in the room, both white males, mid-30s, been in the military for about 15 years. They've been in the same regiment together. They were almost like twins. Brothers from another mother or something, I think they called it. So they were very close. And at one point, I showed them a picture of somebody with facial piercings, and I have never seen a reaction like it. They both got angry with each other because they had very opposing views on whether people should have facial piercings or not. And each of them was so set in their views, they were trying to persuade the other one to their view and to their way of mind. And it got to the point we had throbbing veins on the temples and, you know, flushes going up and gritted teeth and folded arms. And I just thought, oh my gosh, they're going to have a fight, you know? I was really quite concerned about this. Luckily, tea break and biscuits came into the room, so that sort of calmed the situation down a little bit.
That's a fine British tradition.
It is. Biscuits and tea, yes. Apply a biscuit, which is not a biscuit over in the US, is it? A cookie, sorry. Anyway, so afterwards, we sort of got them back into the room and sort of explained what's going on there. That friction was about cultural values. And when we talk about cultural differences, we tend to think about differences between East and West or different counties or different groups. But actually, yes, values are for everybody. And the thing that particular incident taught me was that if whenever you've got friction, there's going to be something underlying that that relates to somebody's values. Now, learning that made me apply that to my own life. So now, you know, in a meeting, somebody's going, I'm just listening and I'm thinking, oh, hang on a minute, I don't agree with that, and it's making me cross. So instead of jumping back in to have an argument, I do that thing that you're talking about now, which is just hold back a minute, hold that space and listen, because then you're going to understand why they want to do it their way. And it's that, to me, that's the key of getting more effective meetings working, about reducing conflict in work situations. It isn't easy. It took me years, and it does mess with your head a little bit. I can't vote anymore because I can now see both sides of the picture from different angles. But yeah, so those sort of things, they are, you can train them. It isn't easy and it does take time. And you've got to have the will, obviously, and the motivation to do so.
So given potential conflicts in values where these things are stemming from, how do you build resilience then in a team? How do you measure resilience?
Yeah. Let's start with what resilience means.
Please.
It's a very hot topic. Resilience, psychological safety. I see it all over LinkedIn all the time. So what actually is resilient? To me, as a psychologist, it's the ability to bounce back after a crisis. So there are 1,001 different tools to measure resilience, and they'll all have a slightly different take on it. There is a model called the Robertson-Cooper model. It has four components, and I kind of like that because it's fairly simple to understand. So it's made up of confidence. So if you believe that you have the skills and the ability to deal with the problem, you're more confident about it. That makes you more resilient because you're not afraid of what's coming towards you. Self-efficacy is the technical term. Then we have adaptability. And this was the thing I was talking about earlier about spotting underlying patterns and the way that you think. And it's the ability to sort of switch between different modes of thought. So do we stick to the playbook or do we have to take a step back and be more creative and come up with a new solution because it's a new type of threat that's attacking us? Mm. And the example I usually use for this is Captain Sullenberger and landing his aeroplane on the Hudson River.
Yeah.
Perfect example of adaptability, adaptive expertise. He's a pilot. He knew that he needed to land his aircraft somewhere flat, somewhere wide, and not on top of the most densely populated city on the planet. And he didn't have enough fuel to go back. So he took all of those things and he looked at the river. Well, it looked like a big runway. Down you go. If he'd have stuck to the playbook, something else would have happened. But that, to me, is a really good example of adaptive expertise, taking that knowledge and applying it in a completely different way in a new situation. So he'd learned those underlying patterns about how to land a plane. As I said, it needed to be flat, it needed to be wide, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that makes you more resilient. Social support, so relationships, and this is what I've been talking about building trust with those teams. Don't test those relationships when you're under pressure. Get it all out of the way beforehand. Then people can have conversations in a calm way in a difficult environment. That builds resilience because you're not on your own dealing with the problem. And then also it's this sort of self-awareness and the ability to adapt afterwards, the metacognition thing I mentioned earlier. So what did we learn from that experience as individuals, as a team? How can we grow from that and take a positive? So I think there's a saying, every cloud has a silver lining. So yeah. Even when bad things happen, there's something you can learn from it. So all of those things help an individual build resilience. However,
that confidence, adaptability to a situation, you know, metacognition, right?
Yeah.
And you mentioned one more item.
Yeah, the social support.
Social support. So those four factors of that, social support is something that we can inspire and train into a team environment. Confidence and adaptability are individualistic traits.
I disagree.
Some people are just, they're really smart, but they're not confident.
Yeah.
You know, so I've seen this, believe it or not, with physicians. So I come from a family of physicians.
Uh-huh.
And you see it where people they know the subject matter. But anytime it comes to decision time, it's like, no, let's not make a decision. That's the best decision. I just won't make one. And therefore, I'll never be wrong. And, and so it seems like there's a lack of confidence. And then adaptability, again, seems like an individual trait. So should we test for that before you put somebody into a pressure cooker environment? I know it's not practically, especially in our industry where we have a huge workforce shortage, to be able to implement those kinds of filters on a practical basis, because you may not have much of a team left. But when queuing back to the military model, I think if you're applying in a special forces application, they do see if you have the mental toughness to actually
even get
engaged with a program like that.
Yeah.
And in CyberSec, I don't know that it's really that different because you look at...
I don't think it is. I think you're right.
Yeah, I don't think it is.
You can also train it. So that's my... You can train
these things.
And how? If you train them, again, this all goes back to the training things, the cognitive agility, the lots of little nibbles at training. You start to spot the underlying patterns. Somebody who's confident and not very confident will grow in confidence the more times they're put into that situation and they have to make that decision. But they're not doing it under pressure because you're doing those little nibbles of training all the way through. So it's a gradual skill and confidence building thing rather than chucking them into the fire and then going, oh, he didn't cope. You know, get him prepared, get his fireman suit on, metaphorically speaking, before you put him into the burning building. And then even if there, I mean, there's going to be times where that's just not possible. Something happens 2 weeks after somebody starts in the job. But if you've got that social support and those relationships, you've got a team of people doing this thing. So if one person is struggling, it's not all on them. It's on the team. And that is, I guess it's just like football, really, isn't it?
Yes.
They work together as a team to drive forward. But I'm not even a sports fan. I don't even know why I said that.
Sports analogy, you look at... if you look at the sports world, you look at the number of times you hear the broadcasters or the commentators or even the publications focus in on a player or two, right? And it's not about the team in many cases. There's a lot more people than one or two players on that team, right? That actually make it effective. But it seems like there's a lot of focus on individuals. Specific rock stars, if you will.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But you need the whole team to be a rock star.
Yeah.
And I guess that leads to the next question is that when you don't have that, or let me rephrase it. Why do teams who even have gone through this kind of a program and we've trained in resilience and we've drilled in exercises, why do they still fall apart under pressure? Have you seen that happen?
Yeah. It goes back to that amygdala hijack I talked about right at the beginning of our conversations, because it's going to, and their resilience. I had somebody I was talking to who was a crisis response expert, a global crisis response expert, had been doing this for several years, very confident, went in and her exact words were, I know what I'm supposed to do, but I kind of didn't know what to do. And that was that amygdala hijack response. It was a particularly nasty thing that was going on. It was going to have an immediate effect on the way that the business was running, which was going to have a global impact and everybody was going to know about it. So that immense pressure meant that even her in that time just didn't, she's just froze. She couldn't do anything about it. What she found was that having an explanation of why that happened helped rebuild her confidence, because she lost a lot of confidence at that particular point in time. But because she then came and learned what it is that causes that, she realised that actually, do you know what? That was just a reaction thing in that particular situation. It doesn't mean that I can't do my job. It doesn't mean that I've lost my nerve or anything like that. And she became more accepting of it. And again, that the whole team piece, because everybody felt like that in the team in that one particular moment. So it was a bonded team. And actually, even though they sort of fell apart under pressure, in spite of all of their training and experience, by sharing that experience and talking about it afterwards in an after action review, it properly bonded that team together and rebuilt the confidence afterwards to go back and carry on the good fight.
So what would you say to the executive, and there's a bunch of them, who would say, Beck, you know, we don't like to talk about the negative. Let's just focus on the positive and move on.
Yeah.
So then that kind of a review really never takes place in that kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah. And it's you know, it's just a case of, oh, it's done. We, you know, let's move on and move forward to the next thing. We don't like talking about the negative, but as adults, the way we learn is we learn by making mistakes. So by ignoring the negative, you're not learning. And it was, I did a really interesting piece of work looking at this after action review with the UK military, but I also did it with the US military and the Canadian military. So it was interesting to see how three different countries did the same approach. And they all do the after action review. And it's a case of, we know it's going to take time. We might not feel like it. We might not want to actually acknowledge what's gone on, but we're going to do it because if we do it and learn from it, we pass it on to the next people that are going through training, ready to go out on operations. And that's called double loop learning. You've learned by your mistakes and you've made sure that you've passed that on in training and it doesn't happen again. And it's about a mindset and an organisational culture. Are you a learning organisation? Do you want to be a learning organisation? Do you want to pick up from those errors? And interestingly, as I'm saying that, is the aviation industry have got this absolutely nailed. They have what's called a just culture. And a just culture is a culture whereby it's okay to make mistakes as long as we talk about it, we learn from it and we put it right. And there's no consequences, job losses or anything like that for people who make mistakes, honest mistakes, and we learn from it as a team. There are insider threats, people who are not making honest mistakes, they're doing deliberate sabotage. That is always dealt with appropriately and you are off you go. So it's about but understanding that by looking at mistakes and understanding how it happened in a no blame situation, just a very factual way, then actually we can learn from that and put it right. So that, I think I've seen quite a lot of people talking about cybersecurity culture. And that to me is where aviation absolutely got it right. And it would be useful to move towards that sort of culture. She said like it's the easiest thing on the planet. Which it isn't, I know. I mean,
do you have any data, even anecdotally, on people who are implementing this kind of a review mechanism, an after action report, quote unquote, and then have faced the same situation again, what's the percentage increase in effectivity that's taken place?
That's a really difficult question. I wouldn't want to put numbers on it. I've seen it happen lots of different ways, but I've also seen it go badly wrong. And I think one of the examples we used to use with our human factors students when I was working in the industry was looking at aircraft accidents. Look at NASA and things that happened with major accidents there. And 20 years later, something happens again. You're never going to get rid of all of that. But as humans, we're not very good at remembering things. And you think, you know, 20, 30 years, people move on. There's a new generation comes up and they have to make the same mistakes again. So I think it's about being realistic about what you can achieve, but at least do your organisation the favour of trying your best to put it right, rather than just ignoring it and moving on.
That's and it's an interesting, a very practical thought.
I am kind of practical, but I think it's something that I know it so well and I've seen it so much over 20 years, I find it difficult to understand why people don't get it.
So explain the wicked problem to us. I came across that term when we were researching some of your work. What exactly is its implications and how do you prep for this thing?
So, yeah. Please. A wicked problem is exactly that. It's wicked because it's not easy to deal with. You've got a normal problem space is you can identify the different factors that are part of the problem. You can look at evidence, you can attribute cause to it and all of that sort of thing and work out a way forward. A wicked problem, and this is so typical of cybersecurity, I feel, is it's fast-paced. So everything is happening really, really quickly. So you've got a whole bunch of information coming at you from different directions. Some of that information is quality, some of it is not. The situation's changing very, very rapidly. There isn't an immediate solution. You can't just press a button, tick a box, and everything goes away. It might be something that you don't necessarily have experience with. But for me, the wickedest part of it, if you like, is the fact it's a zero-sum game. So whatever you do that is right in one area might well cause a problem in another area. So therefore, there isn't always that obvious path to take, because there's always something bad's going to happen regardless. And it's very much a case of having to find the least damage compromise at each step and understand, cyber attack being a perfect example, that you take a series of steps and you have to manage the situation each day as it comes, because you can't just solve it straight away. So that is right. A wicked problem.
That brings us to what you just described there, where you have potentially outcomes that are going to be damaging regardless of whatever action you take. The question is, yeah, which of less evils do I pick here?
Yeah.
That brings in the chain of command issue. And this, and again, this is my personal opinion. So when we look at cybersecurity teams, they're usually composed of a bunch of technocrats, whether mm-hmm. from the CIO, CISO, on down to the analysts and threat hunters and the entire team. Mm-hmm. Those folks are not empowered or designed to make those competing decisions.
Yeah.
Okay. An example would be, well, if I take this server offline, it's going to kill our credit card transactions for an mm-hmm. hour. That has all kinds of financial implications. Or if I take this server offline, the last 15 minutes of orders or the last 15 minutes of shipments are completely lost. Okay. They don't have the authority or as they say, the pay grade to actually make those decisions. But the people who do often are not part of a cybersecurity team or are not included or don't even understand the risk.
Yeah.
What do we do here? I mean, how do we address this? Because these people need to be brought in, and I want a real psychologist to tell us about this and not me.
Two things that are springing to my mind as you're talking there. First is that why aren't those people from other areas of the business brought in to work with, train with the incident response team? Because then you're kind of listening to those issues as you go along. They're there, people, they begin to appreciate each other's roles. Well, I think I've talked about this several times throughout. So why aren't they training with them? And it doesn't mean that they have to take, 3 days out of the office to do some massive tabletop exercise and all the rest of it. It can be like little scenarios every now and then. And then you have those conversations in that safe space, understand why business development or business operations want to do one thing and the IT people want to do a different thing. Have those conversations. Where are we locking heads? Where are we, where are the clashes?
And I think there's time, may I interrupt for just one second?
Yeah, sure.
It appears that it's what you presented something brilliant there. Why are they locking heads? They come from two different social cultures. They mm-hmm. have two different value sets. And as often as I've heard in the halls, never the two shall meet. So you have people who understand the business. They understand mm-hmm. what they're selling. They understand their customers, the market, and how to operationalize that and gain access to the market. There's a whole bunch of people on the technical side that don't know the first thing about that, but understand how the signals go across the wire that enable that transaction to take place.
Yeah.
Right. But they don't know what happens if that signal doesn't make it. They don't know how upset customers get if they don't get their orders. That's something that's completely out of their paradigm. Yeah. And so they don't have a common language that actually brings them together. Yeah. Although they're working for the same cause, which is really kind of strange.
I mean, it's a massive problem. It's also quite well researched. I came across some research that had been done, I think it was the Norwegian military. And the situation they described there is they called it working across the hybrid space. because you've got tactical, operational, online, real life, and you've got to have somebody who can, what they say, navigate that space. And I came across, it was one of the UK banks, had actually solved the problem by putting somebody into the team whose job it was to translate technical language into business and vice versa, so people understood it. But that's quite a mature crisis response team.
Wow, that's a very mature crisis. I haven't seen too many of those. Yeah.
Yeah, personally. I haven't. No,
that's me great either. That there's someone doing it.
Yeah, so one I've come across. But what the Norwegian research was, that actually it's about, again, having those conversations. So business person comes in and explains, well, actually, if you do that operationally, it means that the customers won't be able to do this, the suppliers won't be able to do, you know, so actually spells it out to the tech people. Then the tech people also listen to those stories, coming, you know, give their own stories. Well, actually, this is what we need to do, and this is why we want to do that. And when they have that discussion and they begin to understand why each one has its different point, is you start to find that people can generally then start to look at, where is the compromise? Where is the middle point for this? And there's a professor in Australia, Professor Debbie Ashenden. She's Prof of Cybersecurity at Adelaide. And she's done a bunch of research into this. And she's written a wonderful paper on design thinking. And it's about bringing those teams together right at the start and getting them to design systems and processes, but design them as a joint team instead of separate ones and chucking something over the fence, and then the next person does their job. And what she found in her research was, is that because they were designing the system or the reaction, you know, the playbook together, it led to a lot of an increased understanding. So again, there are things you can do, but it's about being creative and looking at doing things different within the organization. And not everybody likes change.
Nobody, yeah. And if nothing changes, nothing changes. So
yeah. Yeah. If we keep doing what we've always done, we keep getting what we've always got. I don't know who said that, but very apt, I think.
I think it's easy. I know at the executive level, if you are not at all familiar with any or uncomfortable with technical things, or you perceive you're uncomfortable, or you don't want, it's like, well, I don't do that stuff, then it's very easy to be very dismissive.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And when you're dismissive, I think you're doing your organization an injustice, because what you're saying to have happen is almost impossible to have happen, unless it's got the command and control structure acknowledging that, really bad things can happen. And we better be a part of this.
Yeah. And that's a bit like security awareness training. Because I will put my hands up and admit, years ago when I got my security awareness training when I was working at the university, mandatory training, you put mandatory in front of anything and I immediately switch off because I know it's probably going to have nothing to do with me. And I would go through that, my fire extinguisher identification training, my manual handling training. I had to do it, otherwise I'd get told off. They sent me emails badgering me every couple of weeks because I hadn't done it. I log on to the e-learning system and I get through it as quickly as I can and see if I can still score 100%, because that's the challenge that I'm finding it. That is not learning. That is ticking a box. And I think
that's boring. I mean, everything that comes into that, if you look at most cybersecurity awareness training or the trainings that you're talking about, it's
boring.
Death by PowerPoint, and it's boring.
And I don't get it. Why does it apply to me? I mean, at the time I was an academic, so I'm doing research, I'm lecturing. Why is cybersecurity there? So we've got an IT department. They do all that, don't they? You know, that was sort of my attitude towards it. Obviously, I then started working in cybersecurity and was embarrassed into, you can't behave like that anymore, because actually you now know why it's really important. And the thing that I found is that if people understand how it applies to them in their role, they become a little bit more interested. And there's also that thought of, one thing I've heard of quite a lot recently is explaining it in terms of the Internet of Things. So we've all got Alexa in our house now, we've got our Ring doorbells and all of that sort of thing. And if you start explaining cybersecurity in a way that means that actually something bad is going to happen in my house and we're going to nick the money out of my bank account, that sort of thing, then all of a sudden it comes to a bit higher up my agenda. of interest. Yes. So it's about finding creative ways of engaging people. Gamification, that's an ideal way for those who like games. For people like me who don't give a toss about a leaderboard, it's not going to engage me anymore. But I might care that my mum might get conned in some way out of her life savings, you know? So it's about lots of different ways to trying to attract people and get their attention. But for me, the biggest thing is, why does it affect me in my job? You tell me what it does for me in my role and what part I play, and maybe I'll find it interesting, or at least open my mind to it.
You know, what you just said is awesome, because we've often said this about people who are in the business of making cybersecurity policies. So in a lot of organizations, the cybersecurity teams are looked as the people of no. Everything is no, right?
Yeah.
But and that's a very, they've done themselves a disservice by getting labeled that way.
Yeah.
And it's exactly because they're not explaining the why behind these policies.
Yeah. Yeah.
In tangible terms. Because when you tell someone you can't connect a free Wi-Fi at Starbucks, they're going to be ticked. Like, what the heck do you mean? I go out for lunch, and that's when I get caught up on season 7 of my favorite TV show. Right? And I'm not doing that over my data plan. I'm going to connect to the free Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
But if you explain it to them, okay, if you do that and you use that, your phone for work, well, now you've just created an open channel into your job function.
Yeah.
And your job function can have dramatic consequences on your employment, and which means it affects your employment, which means it affects money. So take it out.
Yeah. But then even then, it's never always going to work. Think about how many times, why do some people smoke? Why do I eat so much chocolate when I know it's bad for my heart and my arteries? Why don't I exercise as much as I should do? Yeah. Why don't people listen to the instructions on an aircraft, the safety instructions?
They're boring. You know?
Exactly. You know, it wouldn't be boring if the plane is sort of heading down and you've got to put the life jacket on and get out the door. You know, it would be less boring then, but it's too late. But I think there's going to be some real reality here. Not everybody's going to comply. So you're never going to get that whole, you know, the compliance 100%. People speed. People do bad things to other people. People steal. You know, it's human nature. It's a rich melting pot. You can only do the best you can do. But again, if you understand why people aren't interested and what possibly hook could you get to make them even a little bit interested, then that's got to be better than nothing. So I think there is this sort of, you have to be a little bit realistic. Peer pressure is a wonderful way to make people do things.
Yes. Now, that's a very cool concept. Now, Beck, we are actually a little bit over the hour.
I'm so sorry.
No. We need to have you back. I want to continue this conversation. There's just so much here. We're just scratching the surface of things. But I want to give you an opportunity to let the audience know of anything that you'd like. If you have any books, publications, appearances, whatever you want them, whatever you'd like to plug. You have the floor for the next 2 minutes. Whatever you'd like to tell them, please go right ahead.
I haven't written any books, so I'm too busy doing it. So my business, Mind Science, is all of the things I've talked about today. I run workshops in those things and help people just try and put it into their daily lives, understand why they do what they do, and then help them develop those skills to become more adaptable. And when you see it in action, it's just fabulous. So look for me on LinkedIn, put Mind Science into the search bar, you'll find me, and I'll quite happily talk psychology to you and how you can make it work for your business.
Fantastic. Well, Beck, we really appreciate you being here. You've been awesome. And we're looking forward to actually having you back if you would consider
that. Oh, absolutely. I find it an utterly fascinating subject. And we haven't, like you say, we haven't even scratched the surface, really. So, anytime, I'd be delighted. That'd be wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much.